to the political cesspool known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Welcome, everybody, to another live installment of our award-winning radio program, The Political Cesspool. It's good to have you with us this Saturday evening, May the 15th, as we broadcast to you live yet again from the friendly confines of AM 1380 WLRM Radio in Memphis, Tennessee, going out, as always, to our AM-FM affiliate stations, courtesy of the network that syndicates our fine program, the Liberty News Radio Network. Online, catch us at thepoliticalcesspool.org or libertynewsradio.com, where our live internet stream and broadcast archives are always available to you. Joining me this first hour, Keith Alexander. Keith, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on, James. As always, as you know, this is one of my favorite shows of the year. It's a tradition here at the Political Cesspool that we commemorate the momentous Brown versus Topeka Board of Education Supreme Court decision on our show date that's nearest to the anniversary of that decision, which was May the 17th, 1954, and this is it for this year.
Keith, you're exactly right. Here in the Political Cesspool, where there are several anniversaries that we commemorate annually on the program, our Confederate History Month tribute in April is always something that we take the time to do. Of course, we celebrate the Political Cesspool's birth every October 26, 2004, our first night on air. We always have a little birthday party as we grow a year older. And Christmas is another one that we always take the time to commemorate. And yes, this time, Keith, the anniversary rolling around, far more ominous as we do every year. As you just mentioned, Keith, we will be kind of laying down the destructive nature of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which was decided this week back in 1954. And Keith, why is it so important to both me and you that we bring this to the audience every year without fail?
Well, it's probably the most important United States Supreme Court decision ever rendered in the history of the Republic, and that's saying quite a bit. It was the watershed moment in modern American history. It was the opening shot, or at least the first great victory, for the left in the culture war. And what's more, it provided the blueprint or the template for all subsequent liberal victories. Liberalism now rules America, and the so-called mainstream conservatives are so cowed by charges of racism that they turn into a quivering mass of jelly at the mere mention of the word, and we can trace all of this back to the Brown decision, James.
Well, we can, Keith, and it, you know, as you've said before on this program, it is a date in which the American experiment, at least from a cultural perspective, was perhaps at its zenith, and ever since then, we have seen a very rapid and steady cultural decline to the denigration that we're at now, which, I mean, the America of 2010 in no way whatsoever resembles the America that existed when our grandparents were growing up. I mean, just a very short time ago, 1954, not that long ago at all, when you think about how far America has fallen in such a short period of time. And, Keith, you know, you and I kind of marked it in our own special way this week when you came by the house. We did our show prep for tonight's program, and we watched The Little Rascals a little bit. I mean, never would you see a show that wholesome on the mainstream television airwaves now, and that's just one of many things that has suffered since Brown versus Board. And Keith, you would agree that all of the decline that we've experienced, the march through the institutions, through the church, through education, through academia, the media, so on and so forth, the government, it all stems from the Brown decision. It was the Pandora's box that was opened.
That's right. It was the camel's nose in the tanner, the opening of Pandora's box. In fact, another cultural landmark that we've been mentioning recently is the movie Shane, which I don't think accidentally was released in 1953. And that shows a world where men are men and women are women, and both are glad that they have masculine men and feminine women. Now, we live in a world now transformed by Brown and liberalism where feminized men and masculinized women seem to be the order of the day, and we wonder why the white population is declining. I quite frankly think, James, that it wasn't an accident. I think this was intended by the cultural Marxist left, and they started out with what they considered to be their strongest suit, the race issue, in which to achieve their first landmark beachhead victory. And that landmark beachhead victory, James, was none other than Brown versus Board of Education.
Well, elaborate a little bit more, Keith. I mean, people are probably listening if they haven't heard this program before in years past. And, of course, we're live tonight. This is just kind of a recreation of the show we do every year around this time. But people are probably wondering, Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, that was an order that basically instituted forced integration in the schools. Now, how does that relate to the overall downfall of American culture? How do you connect those dots, Keith?
Well, actually, it didn't mandate forced integration. It led to that, a la the camel's nose in the tent analogy. What it did was it challenged the decision of Plessy versus Ferguson, which in 1892, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause and Due Process Clauses were satisfied by separate but equal facilities among the races. In other words, you weren't violating the equal protection rights of blacks or other racial minorities if you provided separate facilities with them, so long as those facilities were equal. Now, that was what Brown versus Board of Education confronted. And, you know, to get into the decision just briefly, it was unfairly and unethically achieved. I think that's been very well established over the passage of time since the decision. It was the stratagem of Felix Frankfurter, who at the time was the only Jewish member of the Supreme Court. You see, now we have a Supreme Court in which we have three Jews, six Catholics, and no white Protestants, which were the founding stock of America. And see, that just shows you what the left means when they exhort you to let down your guard in the interest of diversity or tolerance or fairness. Once they gain the upper hand, fairness, tolerance, diversity go out the window. And in this decision, James, Felix Frankfurter,
you know,
like Dr. Frankenstein, and Philip Ellman, his former law clerk, another good son of Israel, was like Igor to Dr. Frankenstein. Are we coming up on a break, or can we go into this more?
No, not quite yet, but I will ask you to pause right there because the break's not too far ahead, and you mentioned something there with regards to the way the Zionist Jews perceive freedom of speech, and obviously they don't look upon it too favorably, as Brother Nathaniel Kapner so exquisitely articulated last week.
Well, as Dr. Kapner said, or as Brother Kapner said,
the number of Jews that we have on the United States Supreme Court, and we did a blog entry about that this week, not to get off the subject, that asked rhetorically how many Christians are on Israel's Supreme Court, and of course the answer is zero. And then you have to ask the question, why is the Jewish population, which represents about 2% of the overall United States population, about to make up a third of the highest court in this once Christian nation? And you've got Elena Kagan, who, as we will demonstrate over the course of this first hour, how Brown versus Board helped propel her and others like her into such prominent positions of authority, is not only a radical liberal who wants to restrict free speech, she's also a lesbian. And in lesbians, liberals, homosexuals of all stripes have been bragging about her being the first openly homosexual Supreme Court justice. But anyway, long story short, Keith, Brown had a hand in all of this. And again, we're going to get into this a little bit more deeply as the hour continues. But this is, am I wrong in saying that, again, not to sound repetitive, but that this decision really paved the way for the dominoes to fall one by one, leading us to our present-day malaise?
Yeah, absolutely. And furthermore, what it shows is that all the protestations the liberals make when they're seeking to gain a particular advantage, win a particular Supreme Court case, get a particular law passed, that this is as far as it's going to go, and you don't have to worry about these more extreme things happening. All of that is total hogwash. This is that they have learned via the cultural Marxists that lies and deceit are better weapons than guns and bullets, and they've conquered America by lying to America, James.
Keith, hold it right there, my friend. We are just getting started, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to blow this wide open. You're not going to hear a show like this give you this take on Brown versus Board anywhere else in the world except for the political cesspool. We're going to continue with it right after this.
Cesspool coming your way right after these messages.
When the truth is found to be.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. James Edwards and Keith Alexander in studio with you. The first hour of tonight's live broadcast, we are doing our annual, I don't guess tribute is the right word, but our annual a debunking of the myth that Brown versus Board of Education was somehow a good day in American history when, in fact, it was one of its darkest days. But before we continue our coverage of that issue this first hour, I want to remind you that this radio program has absolutely been on fire in recent weeks. As always, we've been covering a lot of hot topics on the show's website and blog, and this week I hope you're enjoying our takes on Elena Kagan, the latest on the illegal alien invasion, and so much more. Our on-air commentaries, as we're proving again tonight, have never been more precise, and our daily blog entries never more sharp. I encourage you to simply review our shows and articles since May 1st and tell me that I'm wrong. But through it all, it is thrilling, and I say this from the heart, thrilling to be able to continuously prove that our paleoconservative and America First ideas, presented in a very candid and uncensored way, are still so widely accepted by the public that the left would have thought would have been too brainwashed to accept traditional ideas and values in this day and age. But much more than just maintaining our high-profile status quo here on this radio program, I do want to tell you quickly that we have much more exciting news forthcoming by the end of this month. A very special project that I've been working on since October is nearing completion. We're expecting a June 1st release date. And it's going to be something that we're working on that will certainly complement our radio program, and bring more listeners to it. So, indeed, the Political Cesspool Radio Show is nearing yet another peak. So I encourage you to mark our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org, as one of your daily reads, and keep your ears and eyes peeled on our show each Saturday night live for our big announcement. And, Keith, that being said, turning it back over to you as we continue to examine and analyze the Brown versus Board of Education disastrous decision.
Okay, first of all, I want to touch a little bit on how it was both unfairly and unethically achieved, how this decision was achieved. The defense lawyer or the respondent's lawyer on this particular petition for certiorari that brought the Brown case to the Supreme Court, it had lost at the lower level, both the trial court level and at the Court of Appeals level, was John W. Davis. John W. Davis was a prominent Democrat. In fact, he was the last conservative Democrat to run for president as a Democrat in 1924. He was the founder of a famous, still existing, silk stocking Wall Street law firm, Davis, Wardwell, and Polk. And he was a former Solicitor General of the United States, which meant he argued cases for the United States in the Supreme Court and in other courts. And he had been nominated or suggested as a nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court several times during his illustrious career, but had turned it down because he enjoyed being a courtroom lawyer and an appellate lawyer so much. Let me say that Davis was totally unimpressed with the NAACP's argument in the Brown versus Board of Education case because the legal constitutional precedent of separate but equal was firmly established in the law. You had a 62-year-old precedent dating back to Plessy versus Ferguson And there was no question that on constitutional grounds, there was no basis for changing the law. When he got the brief from the NAACP and from the other parties, including the American Jewish Congress, which we'll touch on later, he was incredulous. He said, this is nothing but fluff. He basically said, and this is a quote from him, he said, I can only say that if that sort of fluff can move any court, God save the state. Well, believe me, the state needed saving by God, because that's exactly what the court did in this case, but it didn't do it in the normal course of events. It did so because of the machinations of Associate Justice Felix Frankfurter, who at the time was the only Jewish member of the U.S. Supreme Court. On the other side of the case, on the NAACP side, was Philip Ellman, working as an assistant with the Solicitor General of the United States. Now, Ellman had been, well, he was another son of Israel, just like Frankfurter, and had been Frankfurter's law clerk back in the early 40s. And Frankfurter felt he had a close relationship with him, and what Frankfurter did, like Deep Throat in Watergate, he would call and meet surreptitiously with Ellman and tell him what the various members of the U.S. Supreme Court that had heard the case were saying in their private conferences. This was a gross violation of judicial conduct and ethics, and would have gotten Frankfurter kicked off of the Supreme Court had it been known at the time. It only came out in the 80s. When Ellman wrote an article for the Harvard Law Review basically bragging about his role in subverting justice and getting the Brown versus Board of Education decision granted. He thought it was going to be lionized, but even liberal Harvard was horrified at what he and Frankfurter had done. Now, the Chief Justice at the first hearing of the case was Fred Vinson of Kentucky. Vinson felt that the constitutional precedent was set, and that if there was a change to be made in America's public policy towards race relations, it should come from the legislature. And that's exactly the proper, appropriate separation of powers in concept of our government that should have been applied. That was, Vinson was right. Then Frankfurter could see that his argument and his side of the case was going down in flames, so he desperately asked Vinson for a rehearing, and Vinson, being a Southern gentleman, granted it. In the interim between the first argument and the second argument, Vinson was struck down and killed by a heart attack. Shortly thereafter, Ellman reported in his Law Review article, he met secretly with Frankfurter, who told him in mock sorrow, I'm shocked. And then he confided to him, you know, Vinson's death is the first real evidence I've ever had of the existence of God. That shows you what a kind and godly man Felix Frankfurter was. Frankfurter was a liberal ideologue. Vinson was a judge with a proper judicial temperament and a proper conception of the separation of powers that is supposed to govern the American federal government. Now, Kenneth Clark's doll studies, Kenneth Clark was a black sociologist who did these doll studies that were a big part of the court's decision. In these doll studies, he said he had a black doll and a white doll, and he showed it to black children in Arkansas, and that the black children chose the black doll more often than the white doll, showing that they were negatively impacted by segregation in their self-image and self-esteem. What he failed to tell the court was that he ran the exact same experiment in integrated Massachusetts, where they had integrated public schools. And in Massachusetts, the black children chose the white doll even more frequently than the kids, black kids in Arkansas did. So if anything, it would show, based on his reasoning, that black kids that attend integrated schools have even lower self-esteem than black kids that attend segregated schools. And of course, he suppressed this evidence from the court and intentionally misled the court.
Keith, well, that's as good a stopping point as any. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue on with Keith Alexander's excellent analysis right after these words from our sponsors.
Right after these messages.
Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
Welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It's our annual expose on the Brown versus Board of Education decision that was levied against this country in 1954. It's an annual tradition here in the political cesspool. Keith Alexander and I have been covering it, not necessarily the entire run of the show. We've been on the air 6 years, but I can guarantee you, Keith, this is at least the third or fourth year consecutive that we have been doing this. And before we get back to it, I want to remind everyone that coming up later in the program tonight, we have a special guest interview. Our featured guest for the evening is Tom Ball, making his third appearance on this program. He is, of course, the author of the book Starving the Monkeys, which deals with economic and financial issues. He's going to be on tonight to talk about the economic collapse, or the coming economic collapse here in America. So a little change of pace second hour. Later on in the show, I'll be joined by Eddie the Bombardier Miller, who will be co-hosting the third hour with me as we get back to two of our most frequented topics the last couple of weeks: illegal immigration and the Tea Party. So all that and more forthcoming tonight on the Political Cesspool radio program. We're just getting started here this first hour. And, of course, this first hour, a little bit different tonight in terms of the way we are presenting it to you. Normally, Keith and I banter back and forth about whatever topic is on the agenda for that particular evening. Tonight, kind of more of a monologue from Keith. He's got the information. He's done the research on this. It's his baby. Keith licks his chops every May, just salivating at the opportunity to lambast Brown versus Board. Not necessarily lambast it, but speak the truth about it. And he is certainly speaking the truth tonight. So, Keith, speak on, my friend.
Well, what we do here at the Political Cesspool is speak truth to power. And I think the most important gift that you can give to the rest of mankind is to learn the truth and to speak the truth. And the truth doesn't get much of a hearing, particularly on iconic liberal events like the Brown versus Board of Education decision. You know, it's ironic that in 1954, May the 17th was Monday, and the day that it was delivered, it was recognized as a momentous decision because many Southern legislators and congressmen and whatnot dubbed it Black Monday. Well, this year, May the 17th, is going to be a Monday, too, this coming Monday. And let me just say that, you know, wrapping up on the skullduggery and machinations that led to the decision, Frankfurter more or less directed Philip Elman to tell Jack Greenberg, who was the real head of the NAACP legal team, and others, including his law clerks on the Supreme Court, to dig up legislative history to prove that the Congress that passed the 14th Amendment to the Constitution in 1866 did not intend to endorse segregation. Well, they started digging, and one law clerk in particular, Alexander Bickel of Yale, discovered that this same Congress that created the 14th Amendment also established a segregated school system for the District of Columbia in the same year, thereby totally torpedoing Frankfurter's argument that they did not intend to endorse segregation. They obviously saw there being that there was no inconsistency or incongruity between having segregated schools and having a 14th Amendment with an equal protection clause and a due process clause in it. But despite that, the left, you know, is not going to let quibbles like that get in its way. With Vinson's death, Earl Warren was appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court by Dwight Eisenhower, a Rockefeller Republican, who was very, you know, in a hard-boiled political way, paying off a political debt. Warren had secured the presidential nomination for Dwight Eisenhower in the Republican convention against Mr. Conservative Robert Taft by, as governor for California, delivering California's 45 electoral votes to Eisenhower, and in return, Eisenhower had promised him the first opening on the Supreme Court, which just happened to be the Chief Justice position. Warren was not a great constitutionalist. He was a power politician who was going to grab all the power for whatever position he had that he could get, and that's what he did. He went along with Frankfurter, and they got the unanimous decision they wanted. Frankfurter wanted a unanimous decision because he knew this was such a startling departure from tradition in America that he wanted to have a mandate of a unanimous decision, and he was busily twisting the arm of Justice Stanley Reed on his deathbed to get that unanimity. So Frankfurter was a monster, quite frankly, in every respect of the word, and he is primarily responsible for this decision. Now that we've gone over that background, what were the effects of Brown on the world then and now? Well, what people don't understand now is that all that Brown did was rule that segregation wasn't legal under the 14th Amendment. It did not require integration of the races or race mixing. It just said you couldn't, for example, draw lines specifically to exclude one race from attendance. And because of residential segregation in neighborhood housing patterns, basically Brown versus Board of Education had very little effect at the beginning. You had a few very industrious, bright black kids that wanted to transfer to white schools, which they did. No white kids, not even the kids of liberals, wanted to go to black schools, and very little change. It was one of these cases where the more things change, the more they stay the same. But, of course, the destructive elements in liberalism weren't satisfied. They believed, as Rousseau, one of the fathers of liberalism, the great French philosopher, said, sometimes men have to be forced to be free. So that's when integration started, basically with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, then with the busing decisions. And the result of all of this, and I would argue that it was all planned from the beginning. This is not some normal evolutionary process according to the Whig theory of history, where liberalism and human freedom are blossoming and budding, and we're always moving to the left, and we're always moving in the right direction, which is what liberals think. This was a cultural Marxist plan from the very beginning, James, and what has happened is that public education generally has gone in the toilet in America. You know, what the Bible says is, do not be deceived, ye shall know them by their fruits. Can a good tree bring forth corrupt fruit? Can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit? Therefore, by their fruits ye shall know them. Well, consider what's happened to public education in a place like Memphis. Not only in formerly white schools, but also in formerly black schools like Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver High School. Even the former black mayor of Memphis, Willie Harrington, admitted that the Booker T. Washington High School that he attended before Brown was a better school, higher academic standards, more discipline, more learning than Booker T. Washington back in the 90s when he made his comments, and I'm sure, if anything, Booker T. Washington has just gotten worse in the interim. Likewise, look at other schools like East High School, Central High School. Look at the SAT scores from the early 50s and the ACT scores from the early 50s. generated by students in these schools and the ones that are generated today. And it's obvious that this wonderful decision has been disastrous to public education. And the people that rely on public education tend to be poorer people. And they're the ones who have really been the victims of the Brown decision. Now, the other victims are white people. White people that do not choose to throw their kids into a black hole of Calcutta called the public schools of most cities, and particularly cities that have large minority populations. So they're compelled to either homeschool or send their kids to ever more expensive private schools. James, just think of the trillions of dollars that have been spent by parents on private school education because of the Brown decision, basically to get the same type of education that used to be available for free in the public schools before Brown. This is what, quite frankly, is one of the primary causes for the decline in the white population in America. It keeps going down because white people generally are conscientious enough not to have more children than they can provide adequately before, and part of adequate preparation or provision for their children is sending them to a good school.
Keith, hold it right there. We got one more second on Brown versus Board coming up right after these words.
The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the Political Cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
You know, my friends, as the primary host of this program, I am usually the one that gets all of the credit or all of the criticism for the successes or shortcomings of the Political Cesspool. But one thing that I am is smart enough to surround myself with great talent. And as you listen to Keith Alexander tonight, you understand what I mean by great talent. And it's not just Keith, Bill Rowland, Eddie Miller, Winston Smith, the other three co-hosts that we have here in the All-Star Stable of Talent. It is enjoyable for me to be able to come to work and have such knowledgeable people to lean on. And on a night like this, when Keith comes so prepared, it is so sharp, I know the best thing to do is just to stay out of his way and let him plow into the end zone, because there is little I could add to the first hour's commentary tonight that would improve upon that which Keith is delivering. Where else, Keith, but this radio show, are you going to hear more honest opinion than here in the Political Cesspool? We have the best political talk radio program in the country. We have the most insightful political talk radio in the country. We have the most honest political talk radio show in the country. And for a decision that was so ominous and so terrible, you would imagine that there would be more than one show here on this anniversary of Brown versus Board that would be covering all that it brought to America. But no, we are the only one. And sadly, that's not surprising, Keith.
Yep. I forget who it was who said it, but some famous man said, live not by lies. And unfortunately, the only place where you can get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth on the Brown decision is the Political Cesspool. The reason it's so important, James, is I hark back to one of your trademark sayings, you can't have a first world country with a third world population. Well, one of the main reasons why we have a increasingly third-world population, of course, it all tracks back to liberalism, open borders, illegal immigration being tolerated and whatnot, but the other side of that coin is the declining white birth rate. And the declining white birth rate is, in many respects, a product of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. Look at it from a typical white couple's viewpoint. They live in a community where the public schools have gone to hell in a handbasket because of Brown. Now, they're going to limit the size of their family. what are they going to do? Let's say they have a third child. They have two children, and then they have a third child, and they're just barely making it, can barely afford to pay the private school tuition, which tends to go up every year, and they find themselves with another baby on the way. Or they're thinking about having a baby. What are they going to say? Well, gee whiz, honey, we're sorry. Your older brother and sister get to go to this swanky private school, but we've run out of money, so you need to go to Booker T. Washington. We hope you make it back in one piece. Well, they don't do it. And quite frankly, I wonder how many abortions. I wonder how many how much contraception is driven by the realities thrust on white parents and parents-to-be by the Brown decision. See, this is the way, you know, the white population decline is a result of a lot of things, and most of them are liberal. For example, knuckleheads like Dr. James Dobson focus on the family in an effort to avoid confronting the issue of race, claim that modern whites are just too self-centered and hedonistic in America to have children. He doesn't think about the consequences of having children. You don't want to throw your kids into the black hole of Calcutta. Think about this. I was looking at my wedding photo the other night. I was going through some old photo albums, and I was looking at this picture of all the groomsmen and bridesmaids. There were 11 of them. And I was looking back. That's been over 25 years now. Out of those 11 people, they have 11 children. Some of them had no children. The most fertile bunch was my wife and me. We had three children. Other people had two. Some people had one. Some people had none. But basically, when 11 cup people have 11 children, that means that the population is being cut in half for the next generation. And that's happening, I think, largely because of Brown and other liberal things like feminism. Another thing that I would point to is I attended a college graduation this weekend. At that college graduation and a dinner that they had at the time, I was watching the speakers. I went to the baccalaureate service. I went to a Phi Beta Kappa dinner. I went to all sorts of different things. And I was struck by the incredible number on the faculty and even among the student body of feminized men and masculine women. Well, that's not the ideal situation for procreation, James. Women are biologically patterned to want masculine men, and men, likewise, are patterned to want feminized or feminine women. And if you have feminized men and masculine women, that will undoubtedly cut down on fertility and the number of children. And again, where did we get this? We got this from feminism. And where did feminism come from? Another aspect of liberalism. So see, it's like it's a great evil plot unfolding to basically squeeze off the growth and make the white founding stock of America not have children. It's incredible, really. And, I was watching the baccalaureate service. They had a Jew reading Torah scriptures and a Muslim reading Quran scriptures in a Christian church. Now, just think to yourself, too, you think that that would play in reverse? Do you think that in the Jewish temple they would allow us to be reading Christian scriptures, or in the Islamic holy place or temple or whatever they call it, they would be allowing Christians and Jews to be reading the scriptures? Of course not. Again, this is all, you know, it seems like it's part of the plan to basically put an end, choke off the founding stock of America. And it's doing a wonderful job of doing that, James. It's and the result is fewer children, and it's more burdensome to have children now than it was in 1954. And conscientious people don't want to have children they can't provide for. So So my ultimate conclusion about all of this, James, is that Chief Justice Vinson of Kentucky was right. Race is a thicket that the court should have steered clear of and left for resolution by the legislature. That's the way the Founding Fathers intended great social issues to be determined. And the result has been disastrous and may well end up being the decline and fall of America. What should have been done was well summed up by the late, great paleoconservative thinker Sam Francis. Here's what he said. He said, "What you think the state ought to do about race has little to do with what you think about race. It has everything to do with what you think about the state. Under the properly limited federal government with which this country started out and to which it should return, the state would be unable to do very much at all about race. In the modern Leviathan state created by liberals, where smoking, sexual beliefs, and guns are appropriate targets of federal meat grinding, there's no limit to what the state might do about race or those whose IQ it doesn't approve of." See, this is, you know, this is where we are when we vary from the blueprint of the Founding Fathers, and I don't, quite frankly, think that we would have varied from it were it not for Jewish power and influence, particularly on the Supreme Court. You know, we've been talking about Elena Kagan being a great adversary of freedom of expression, a real fan of hate crime and hate speech laws. And, you know, that blog entry of yours gave me an occasion to look back and consider Jewish Supreme Court justices from Louis Brandeis, who was the first one onward. And what you see is a consistent pattern of liberalism that basically scorns the strictures of the Constitution. I do not think that Jewish intellectuals think much of the American Constitution, probably because at the time the Constitution was crafted, there were very few Jews in America, and none of the Founding Fathers were Jews. Therefore, how can these guys be very smart, is what they instinctively conclude. Well, let me say this to all the Jewish intellectuals and also the liberals out there. There were never any wiser men in the world than the Founding Fathers when it came to crafting a Constitution to run a government.
Keith, we might have to have a continuation of this next week.
1 hour.
Because we're flat out of time. But we'll be back with more when the Political Cesspool returns right after these words.
Enjoying.
What a great
Thank
job,
you.
Keith Alexander.
Harv leaped to his feet and says, "Something's got a hold on me. Yow!" The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. We're jumping pews and shouting hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of the blooms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the Amen.